Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. And if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing, please consider becoming a KQED member. Get special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.
From KQED. Hey there, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, we have two, count them, two of California's top executive officers with us, Governor Gavin Newsom and Attorney General Rob Bonta.
Looks like when it rains, it pours, Scott. And first up today, we are thrilled to welcome Governor Newsom. He is actually doing double duty this week, of course, his regular day job as governor. But now he is rolling out a children's picture book about dyslexia. It's called Ben and Emma's Big Hit. Governor Newsom, welcome back to The Breakdown.
Great to be with you guys.
All right. So this is a children's book about dyslexia. This is something that you've been very open about, your personal struggle. I know you write at the end of the book that you learned of this diagnosis at age 10. Can you talk about how you learned of it and what having that sort of label changed for you, if anything?
Yeah, my mom kept it from me for all those years. And I stumbled upon it after school, came home and found a file with a sort of yearly update on how I was doing, speech therapy, my spelling, and all the issues that led me to ask my mom, what's going on with me? And she said, where'd you find those files? I said, you left them out. And she said, well, you have something called dyslexia. And she never wanted to stigmatize me with it. She didn't share that with me. And I'll be candid with you, I just assumed everybody was going after school to get some remedial help or had summer programs to learn how to read, not realizing that I was struggling with this and not all of my classmates were. And so one in five people have some form of language-based learning disabilities, and many have the support that I receive, but most don't. And I really wanted to highlight that and make the point that it is not a liability. And if we get enough early screening done, if we get the kind of intervention that could produce the kind of results to give people some confidence and self-esteem, that it will turn out to be one of the best things that ever happened to a young child, to have a difference that allows you to develop skills that you never otherwise could. And so this is a book about my journey, composite, my journey with a little bit of my personal history with baseball, where I had confidence on the baseball diamond, none in the classroom, and a book we hope provides a little confidence and hope to people that are struggling.
Yeah, and Governor, of course, it's one thing to be, you know, in school as a student learning to kind of cope with dyslexia. It's quite another to be governor of a state like California. And I'm just wondering, what are some of the things you do as, you know, governor, as a person now that, you know, may be affected by your dyslexia? How do you compensate? What do you do differently?
Yeah, and it's the right question because it doesn't go away. And let me give a proof point. Not only did I struggle reading as a kid, I struggle with it today. I don't read speeches. You've never seen me read a speech. If you have, you probably started texting and phoning someone out of boredom. And the few times that I've tried, it's gone horribly wrong. When I was mayor, I tried a few times. I can't do it. As governor, I've never read a speech, with one exception. And that's a teleprompter speech that I need to do once a year that I practice for 100 hours and do a mediocre job communicating. And that's with teleprompter at State of the State. And interestingly, I do it with an open dyslexic font. And that same open dyslexic font I've included in this picture book for children. It just helps me a little bit. Look, it's difficult. Spelling's impossible. The speech therapy really worked. And I didn't realize, you know, I found all these old files that I remember seeing as a kid, and my sister had them. My mom passed away about 18, 19 years ago. And I asked my sister, do you still have those files? And she found them all. And it's so remarkable. The issues that are present in my life today were present when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. And so you find ways to overcompensate, But here, forgive me, so be so long-witted, here's the punchline. The overcompensation is where you develop a muscle that many people don't have. You have a higher average of visual memory. Your ability to problem solve and reason. There's things that are connected, and we know neurologically the brain is different for dyslexics. And there's a reason why so many creatives are dyslexic, so many entrepreneurs are dyslexic. And it's wonderful to be in the ranks of Steven Spielberg and Robin Williams and people, even you know, Tom Cruise is a celebrity and Cher, but also remarkable leaders like Churchill, all dyslexic that had to overcompensate and in that overcompensation found strengths they never otherwise would have.
Are there things you do that, you know, people may annoy people, but which you do because you have dyslexia or that people may not understand? Like I notice when you do a budget presentation, you go on for a very long time with an incredible amount of detail.
A lot of memorization.
I need to do that, and I say that selfishly. I don't do that for you. In fact, quite the contrary. You just made the point. I go on and on and on. I don't think it's particularly effective. But it's important to me because what I'm trying to do is master the subject matter. And what I'm doing is what I've had to do my whole life. And I've said this all my life. I realized I wasn't dumb. I thought most of my life that I was dumb. I think I was in my 30s when I realized I wasn't as dumb as I thought I was. And that's a dyslexic reality. And I realized dyslexia is not intelligence. And intelligence manifests in many different ways. But one thing that I did know, and the one thing I was really proud of, I had grit. I had resilience. I will outwork you. I'll just outwork you. And I always had that. And I had to have that. And so when it comes to the budget, that's just me working. That's me sort of developing a muscle. It's a skill. I don't want to dial that in. I'm learning as I'm going. That's hundreds of hours of preparation. By the way, I've already spent 30 or 40 hours on the next budget.
You can tell us about it now if you know.
Yeah, but it's just important to me in the precision. I know I torture you guys and I torture the public. I always try to correct myself. No one cares about stats and facts, but I need to say it because it hones my... It's a way of sharpening my focus, and it makes me know. It's a way of communicating to myself that I'm on top of the subject matter. I'm not being lazy. So when I say last year, I'll give you an example, our budget this year, Prop 98 budget for education, is $123.9 billion. That 0.9 matters to me, because if I don't have that, I'm not confident in the rest.
All right. Before we let you go, Governor, we, as we said at the top, are going to be talking to Attorney General Rob Bonta in just a minute. He, of course, was appointed by you earlier this year. As you know, there's a lot of debate right now over criminal justice reform and policy, a lot of attention on retail theft and other burglaries. You've supported a lot of those reforms, as has Attorney General Bonta. How are you thinking going into 2022 about making the case to voters not to turn back those reforms? Because I think a lot of folks, where you sit, do not think that they are the reason for this uptick in crime.
I'll say two things. What's happening with crime is unacceptable, period, full stop. We need to hold people accountable. We can't sugarcoat this. This is serious. It's real. We can see it with our own eyes. It's unacceptable, period. And so that's a fact. And that's why I established last July, we announced with 13 big city mayors, a retail theft task force. We've been on top of this for some time. We're going to quadruple down on that in next year's budget. And I've never been one, and you guys have followed me for decades, where I was increasing policing, increasing academy classes. I've never been on that defund police movement. I've been a reformer, but not on the defund. And there's a distinction there. That said, we are going to do more as a state to support cities and counties and the prosecution and accountability. That said, it's important to note some fundamental facts. The reforms that people are attaching animus towards, one in particular, Prop 47, occurred in 2014. Crime dropped in 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19. By the way, that reform was not unique and novel. 39 states, almost 40 states in this country, since 2000, reformed their felony status. California, if you include Vermont, which is $50 less than California, but if you include Vermont, 31 states are equivalent to California. By the way, Texas is a $2,500 felony status. Interestingly, they have higher violent crime rates than California, higher property crime rates than California. By the way, violent crime in California increased 0.8% last year, 5% nationwide. And it's important to look at murder rates happening disproportionately in red states, Montana, South Dakota. states like Kentucky with high murder rates. And by the way, in closing, I'll just make one final point. This is not to excuse what's going on. Again, we need to do more and better and hold people accountable. But the murder capital of California is not L.A. or San Francisco. It's Kern County, with a Republican DA, Republican sheriff, with minority leader Kevin McCarthy in the backyard, a Republican mayor of Bakersfield. So I think there's a laziness attaching smash-mouth, flash mob, retail theft rings and organized crime, and somehow attaching that what's happening at Walgreens and Safeway, which is real, and somehow attaching Prop 47 to it. I think that is, frankly, a little misleading. And I think we, as journalists, as politicians, and members of the public, owe ourselves a little bit of objectivity of the facts, but the feelings are real, and the reality must be confronted.
Well, and as you know, as a politician, better than most, that you can cite all the statistics you want to say crime is down or it's down historically, but if people don't feel safe, and I'm just curious, like, what do you recommend to Democrats who are going to potentially be on the defensive over this?
Well, you just own it. We should own the fact that going into the pandemic, we had some of the lowest crime rates in California's history. We should own up to the fact that right now, this nation, not just California, you've seen these organized retail thefts in Minnesota and Chicago and other parts of the country. You've seen big crime increases in red states, as I said, violent crime, property crime, larcenies, higher in states like Texas. They're real. And all of us have to come to grips with that. It's not unique to California, but these smash-mouth, high-profile recent crimes are. And so we've got to see more police presence. We need to see more uniform police presence. We are providing more data collection on a regional basis. That we've got more CHP officers out there on the roads. They're supplementing a lot of the local efforts. It was good to see what Oakland's doing with more academy classes. We put a record amount of money up called something called CalVIP for violence intervention. I went from $9 million a year ago to $200 million this year, but it's not enough. I'm going to do more still. And I say this often, I'm not the mayor of California, but I'm feeling like I need to be more mayor right now as governor to support the mayors and the prosecution of these folks. I can't stand it. It is unacceptable seeing boarded up parts of our city, beautiful, beloved San Francisco, to see these boarded up retail outlets, including, by the way, my businesses. It's not acceptable. And so Democrats need to step up. Republicans, as I said, Kern County is a perfect example. Texas, another statewide example, need to step up. We all do. And stop scapegoating and stop making this damn political. It's about all of us. And all of us have a responsibility to meet this moment. And I certainly want to be among them.
All right. Governor Gavin Newsom, author of Ben and Emma's big hit. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks,
today.
Governor.
Great to be with you guys. Look forward to what Rob has to say.
All right. Okay. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, we'll be joined by California Attorney General Rob Bonta. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi there, I'm Randa Abdel-Fattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer. Today, we are thrilled to have Attorney General Rob Bonta. He was appointed to the post this past spring following 9 years in the legislature. Attorney General, welcome to the breakdown.
Thank you for having me. Honored to be with you.
Well, we want to talk, you know, we talked with the governor about some of the stuff in the news, but we want to talk about your life first. We haven't had you on the show to talk about your bio. You were actually born in the Philippines to a Filipino mother and an American father. Why were they back in the Philippines? I think they had met here in the States, right?
They had met here in the States in Berkeley at the Pacific School of Religion, and they went to the Philippines, my homeland for my mother, the place of her birth and where she was raised until she was 28 years old, and went to the United States for the first time to serve as missionaries, to serve, to help others, to lift other people up.
And they were both politically active. Tell us a bit about, you know, your dad, Warren, and some of his involvement in civil rights.
My father, as a grad student, was involved in the civil rights movement. He had a friend who was in Selma, Alabama, who was taking audio cassette recordings of this incredible leader talking about justice in a fairer society, and sending those audio cassettes back to my father, who tore open the package, listened, and heard the voice of Martin Luther King Jr. And he felt called to action to go to Selma to be part of the transformative change that was happening. And he did. He jumped on a train, rode for 3 days to be there. He met Stokely Carmichael. He was in church with Martin Luther King Jr. And he organized for civil rights and voting rights. And when he came back to Berkeley, he did the same, organizing for voting rights and civil rights right here in the East Bay.
So you were only in the Philippines, as I understand it, for a couple of years. Do you remember any of that? Were you too little?
I was too little. Parents brought me back to California to rebuild our lives when I was 2 months old.
So okay.
not clearest memories as a 2 month old. It was because of the rise to power of Ferdinand Marcos, his declaration of martial law exactly a year after I was born, that my parents decided to bring me to California.
Did you go back at all? Have you gone back?
I have, multiple times. As a child, as a teenager, right before law school, as an assembly member, visiting my relatives often when I'm there, staying with them usually before I was an assembly member. My mother's side of the family is still there.
So I know that you lived part of your early life after you came back in the Central Valley. Your mom was working for farm workers' rights. Your dad was setting up health clinics. What do you remember from that time? And I think you were like living in a trailer, right? Because this was how organizers lived alongside farm workers.
We did. We lived in the headquarters of the United Farm Workers of America. We lived in La Paz. We lived in a trailer. My family of five. My brother was actually born in Bakersfield while we were there, while my parents were serving the movement. They were each getting $5 a week for their service. My dad worked in the front office with Cesar Chavez, my mom in the preschool. Dolores Huerta was there. The great Filipino-American leader, Philip Veracruz, was there. We would host him in our trailer for Filipino breakfast when he would come for meetings. So they were right in the middle of one of the greatest civil rights and social justice movements in the history of our country.
You know, now that you're grown up and you're AG, that's a great story. It's a great memory. But I'm wondering if when you were a kid, did you ever wonder, like, you know, or say, I just wish I had, like, quote unquote, normal parents who were around all the time.
Yeah.
It was normal for me. It was all I knew. So, I grew up at rallies and demonstrations and protests. And I remember my mom organized for the restoration of democracy in the Philippines after Ferdinand Marcos took power and had his dictatorship. I spent Christmas, the days leading up to Christmas, singing Christmas carols with my mom and her community activist friends to raise money for the restoration of democracy movement. So that's all I knew. And as a young kid, you always trust your parents unconditionally. And I always believed in what they did. I was proud of them, thankful for their work. And as I grew older, I appreciated it even more. And now, as an adult, I want to carry on their legacy.
I wonder if you ever at all felt caught between the cultures. I feel like, you know, when we were growing up, there wasn't a lot of talk of being mixed race, but that's what you are. And I just wonder, like, how that has been going back to the Philippines or being here in California.
Yes. Being biracial is unique and a unique experience, sometimes caught between two worlds, two cultures. But for me, always something I've been comfortable with, my identity, who I am, who my mom is, who my father is, and, you know, who my brother and sister are as well. And, you know, I grew up in a suburb of Sacramento from first grade through high school. It was not very diverse. There were six Filipinos in my high school. Three of them were me, my brother, and my sister. The other three were another set of siblings. And so, definitely challenging, of course, especially being of color in a place that's mostly not of color.
Well, and in that regard, you went to Yale Law School, which I would imagine, especially back then, did not have a lot of people who weren't white. You know, what was that like for you? Was it a kind of culture shock, not just in terms of racially, but, you know, just the whole thing? You have kids from really privileged backgrounds and so on.
And East Coast.
Yeah, all that. Thank you. And I first went to Yale College as a 17-year-old, and that was very different. Being on the East Coast, being around folks with wealth, with multi-generational wealth, many from private schools. I was a public school kid from California, a Filipino-American public school kid from California at that. There were not very many Filipinos. The students of color hung out with each other, and including that's where I met my wife Mia, Puerto Rican from the Bronx. We met as 17-year-old students in an orientation program before school even started at Yale. And to your point about Yale Law School, it's the same. It's a very small law school actually, so you get to know most of your classmates. But the students of color spent time with one another, supported each other, shared stories about resources and opportunities. Among them, Cory Booker, the class above me, and Stacey Abrams, the class below me. So I was around some amazing leaders and proud and thankful for their friendship.
Yeah, that's like bragging rights now, right? Stacey Abrams. So you mentioned Mia Bonta, your wife, who's now holds your assembly seat that you stepped down from. But I want to talk about the work you're doing now, because there's a clear bridge between the work your parents did and a lot of, you know, the work you did as a lawmaker around especially criminal justice reform. But now you're the top cop, right? I guess to start, like, how has that transition been going from somebody who was writing the laws and often on the outside of law enforcement to being on the inside?
You know, there's big differences in terms of the movement from the legislature to the executive branch. In the legislature, you can do anything, but you need many other people to agree with you before you can actually accomplish it. And it's sort of the opposite in the executive branch. You are limited by the existing laws and implementing and enforcing those, but you can move unilaterally in that work. So it's been an adjustment for sure, but the mission has not changed, the values have not changed, and there's actually much more scope and ability and reach to accomplish the goals. And so, my values and my priorities as a legislator continue to be my values and my priorities as the Attorney General. And that includes criminal justice reform, keeping our communities and neighborhoods safe as we always seek to be more fair and more just, housing, protecting our tenants, creating more housing throughout the state of California and many other areas.
You, of course, now as the Attorney General, you have to deal with and listen to and work with district attorneys and sheriffs, law enforcement officials up and down the state. And in the legislature, I would say they probably opposed a lot of the bills that you authored or voted for. Well, talk about that transition and how you've navigated that.
There were times when some of those groups would support some of the bills I was working on, but you're right, oftentimes not. Now it's a time to implement what I've always sought to do as a publicly elected official, which is to collaborate, cooperate, work together, seek and find common ground. While we may not agree on everything, we agree on many things, and we can work on those things together. And I've been going up and down the state working with our law enforcement partners to identify the biggest challenges and to see how we can overcome them and move forward together. So I appreciate the important work to keep our communities safe of our brave men and women in uniform. And whenever we can work together to accomplish our common goals, we do.
Well, let's talk about some of those issues that you're facing and DAs and police chiefs around the state, which is made a lot of headlines. Take, for example, the retail thefts. We just talked to the governor. He talked about increasing kind of help resources to cities and counties. I want to ask you, like, how are you thinking about and what can the state do to do that? Because some of, you know, the things the governor might be alluding to fly in the face of some of the reforms that both of you have actually supported. So what's the balance here and what can law enforcement and government actually do on this issue?
Let me first say I really appreciate the governor's leadership on this. His CHP task force, we're a member of that task force, bringing folks together to address this common challenge. His deployment of resources to places where they're needed most. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways to address this challenge. So to me, it's all of the above approach and, you know, to try to address it from the different angles. Certainly when we can do investigations and prevent the organized retail theft from happening in the first place, which, by the way, is awful, unacceptable. And these are felonies, to be absolutely clear, burglary, grand theft, robbery, organized retail crime under California statutes. When we can arrest on site, we should. We know that catching violators of the law is the best way to deter. And then when we're not able to make those arrests on site, when the crime occurs, then we conduct investigations like the one we announced last Friday, which was the sentencing in one of the largest organized retail crimes in the history of California, $8 million worth of product that was being resold for profit. And we sentenced the ringleader to 6 years in prison.
So that's an organized retail theft. I think that's sort of an easy one. But what about, you know, maybe young kids, teenagers who saw this and took advantage of it? I mean, should those people be prosecuted to the full extent of the law as well? Isn't that sort of flying in the face of a lot of the work that you and others have done to bring less people, particularly brown and black men, into the criminal justice system?
What we're seeing and what people are talking about right now with respect to the brazen thefts that were occurring right before the Thanksgiving holiday, those are organized. Those are organized criminal activities involving, you know, up to 80 people with weapons, planned, acting in concert. Under the law, you aggregate the total amount that is being stolen. So you're clearly in the felony area. If we're talking about shoplifting or a child taking candy from a candy store, then, you know, we have laws that provide the appropriate consequences for the appropriate conduct. And it's lesser, of course, for a child, for a lesser offense, for a lesser amount of property stolen. So, we have enough tools in the toolbox now to use to address the organized criminal retail crime that we're seeing. And we should be using those, and we are.
I know, Attorney General Bonta, you are opposed to the death penalty, as were your two predecessors in that office. There was a state committee that has recently recommended reducing the number of condemned inmates on death row. There's almost 700 of them. There's some thought about negotiating reduced sentences, allowing district attorneys so inclined to do that, like George Gascon in L.A. What are your thoughts about that?
My thoughts are that I personally am against the death penalty. That's clear. I supported a constitutional amendment to end the death penalty in California. I think it's wrong for California. It's, I think, inhumane. It's fallible and irreversible at the same time, and you can't be both. It has a racially disparate impact on Black and brown communities, and it doesn't deter. So I think there's a lot of problems with it. And I'm the chief law officer of the state of California. My job is to implement and enforce the law of the state. And so I'm very interested in the committee's proposal and identifying ways where we might work together within the scope of my obligations and duties.
So does it seem like basically you would support looking for ways to reduce some of those sentences and convert them to, you know, life without the possibility of parole?
I think we're appropriate, including things like mental incompetency and other potential resentencings consistent with the law. So where possible and consistent with the law, yes.
All right. We only have a couple minutes left. We like to end on a fun note. Any good holiday plans? Anything? Did they let you go home and celebrate with your family now that you're the top cop?
They do. They do. I am honored and grateful to have this privilege of a lifetime serving as California Attorney General. But my most important titles are always going to be dad and husband. Husband to Mia Bonta, dad to Reyna, Ileana, and Andres. And the hardest part of the job is striking the right balance, being the dad and husband I want to be, and being the AG I want to be for the people of California. And part of that is finding time in the holidays spent together. I call it mutual stand down time, when no one wants to hear from me, and I spend time with my family. So
awesome. All right, Attorney General, thank you so much for your
time
today.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. Before we say farewell, we want to say goodbye to our amazing colleague, Katie Orr. She is leaving KQED tomorrow. Katie, we love you. You've been a great colleague. We can't wait to see what you do next.
Absolutely. And we want to wish you all the best in your new adventure in Sacramento. We're going to miss you, and hopefully we'll see you as well. All right, our producer here at Political Breakdown is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer, Katie McMurrin. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me at mlagos. Have a good weekend.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.